This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the TrackEye Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. Jeremy Scott here with you. Got a good show for you today. We'll start things off with Will Moradi. He is the, if you remember back in the 100th riding of the Indianapolis 500, he partnered with Sam Schmidt Racing to get Oriel Servia into the field. Well, now he's bringing up a young star from the junior ranks of open wheel racing, bringing him into his USF 2000 debut this weekend, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll find out more about Will, how he got to being such a big, I guess you can say, super fan per se, to become part owner of a team, who he's partnering with now, what driver he's bringing up, and the such. Also, IndyCar insider Nick Yeoman joins us to talk about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, more namely with the Indianapolis 500, and the Worldwide Technology Raceway doubleheader, the Bomarito 500. And we'll also have our driver analyst Charlie Ante to just, you know, riff off of each other and talk about some other things going on in open wheel racing. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and check us out on basically those two. Search for Inside Open Wheel. Leave us a voicemail, 815-714-9260. Those are the best ways to get a hold of us. Now, something that crossed my radar over the weekend, Om Legato, which does the watches for F4 FR Americas, has crafted 100 exclusive F4 watches and FRA watches. They're all numbered, and that's going to, you know, set you back a little bit, but nonetheless, they're very beautiful watches. You can log on to FR Americas or F4 US Championship to find out more. I'm looking at them right now. I'll take either one if you're looking for a Christmas gift for me. It's my over $100 gift idea. Of course, there are a lot of other great departments. Looks like they've got a Derek Bell line. There's also Monzo line, a Tifosi line. Speaking of Tifosi, Charlie and I may talk about that later. We'll see about that. But nonetheless, great news coming out of F4 FR Americas. Of course, now we're going to be mostly in a lull. We're still not sure if IndyCar is going to Mid-Ohio in a couple weeks. We're still waiting on official word from that. We'll talk to Nick Yeoman and see what he knows about the doubleheader weekend, the Honda Indy 200 at the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course. The only thing running this weekend is going to be the Road to Indy Series. It's going to be USF 2000, I should say, Indy Pro 2000 on the road course at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. They're going to be supported by the Mazda MX-5 Cup, so some great racing on tap for that. Our buddy Rob Howden will have the call for that all weekend long on the Road to Indy TV app. Of course, F4 FRA running at the end of the month down in Florida. End of October, Formula Race Promotions, they're going to be running at Pittsburgh International Raceway. Charlie Ante will tell us all about that circuit and what they've done over the past several years. Don't forget also, we're going to be working on our Legends of IndyCar series throughout the offseason. Go back and listen to who we've talked to. Who do you want us to sit down and interview? Tweet us at Inside Open Wheel. We'll make sure to try and get them on. I'm trying to get everything lined up for the off season, so I can just sit down and plug and play. Well, Moradi sits down with us, talks about his new venture in IndyCar next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, we're proud to make a big announcement here on Inside Open Wheel, and it pertains to one of our former guests that we have featured on Inside Open Wheel. He is a standout in the Junior Formula Series, but we're going to have one of his owners on with Will Moradi. Thanks for joining us. A lot of people know a little bit about what you've done, but let's go ahead and start off with who you are and how we got to today.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Jerry. Appreciate it. Yeah. You know, I've been a fan my whole life of motorsports, but particularly open wheel, particularly Indianapolis. And I wanted to be a driver, got out of school, went to Skip Barber, you know, like the story of every driver, but I didn't really have any resource. Family was very, you know, middle class. did it for a couple of years, and then, you know, that was it. I ran out of money, so I was just a super fan. But always loved it. Went to my first Indy 500 in 1982 and just totally fell in love with Indianapolis. And in 2015, I had the crazy idea. I said, you know what? We've got the 100th running coming up. Why not try to put a team together and get in the show? And everybody told me it was impossible to do. Couldn't do it. Long story short, God just really opened up some great doors for us, and we were able to be the co-entrant with Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports on the car number 77, driven by Oriol Servia. And I told my wife that year, this is either going to scratch the itch or it's going to light the fire. And here we are, you know, 4.5 years later. and really now trying to put teams together. We came back in 17. We did the 500 again with Sam and a few other races. And our goal now is to really get into we want to stay on the IndyCar paddock. We want to continue to have a presence there. But we really want to move into an ownership position and build a team over time. And so there's no better place to start than the Road to Indy and USF 2000. And, you know, we knew we wanted to have a really good driver. We had worked with a couple of other folks. But Simon came extremely well-recommended to us from the series. And so we tested him the day after Indy at Putnam Park. And he did very well in the car. First time he drove the car, first time he drove the track. And we said, I think we found our guy. And so that's kind of where we're at today.
Well, Simon Sykes, he's just been a standout so far this year. As we take a look at the 2020 points for F1600, he's dominating. Well, he's leading it, to say the least. But
yeah,
it's been a battle between he and Jackson Lee. But the results speak for themselves, because I don't think you could find a better driver because of the way he's run. You know, he won the first five in a row, and he won the next one at VIR. But this is a kid who I think is going to be one of the next stars of open wheel racing. And this right here is a great start. Now, you are moving on with a team that already seen success this year with another standout, but this driver was an Indy Pro 2000.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. We were at Lucas Oil, and we ran USF car there, and we were very fortunate at that race to have Cameron Shields, who's another excellent driver. Mm-hmm. And the team Legacy Autosport, who we're partnering with, ran a Pro 2000 car with Cody Swanson. And Cody Swanson is amazing. And, you know, he's got such diversity, and I mean, he's just a blast to watch, whether it's dirt or pavement or Silver Crown or midget or whatever he's driving. And I mean, at Lucas, his first Pro 2000 race, first time in the car, and he walked away from the field. It was truly a thing to see. And so there's another great one. You know, Cody's just amazing. He's got a huge fan base, but it was quite a performance what we watched a couple weeks ago at Lucas Oil. So we were proud to be part of that experience as well. And I think Simon is going to be one of the great ones. I think he's got all the attributes. I mean, when we tested him at Putnam Park the day after the 500, and I mean, he just quickly, very adaptable, made good adjustments along the way. He's very intuitive, great feedback to the engineer, just everything you want in a driver. And plus, he's got just the greatest personality, and he's from Georgia, so he's got courtesy in his DNA. Kid is just, he's fabulous. We just love him.
Yeah, he's we've had him on here about a month or so ago. And yeah. I mean, even for as young as he is, he knows his stuff, and that I think is what's going to help propel him. And this is his first true test moving up from 1600 to 2000. So, and Putnam Park is a great playground for these drivers to test, and I've been there a couple times before as an announcer for Regional Sports Car Series. So, you know, to get him out there, it's great to see him that quick.
Well, this is his debut. This is his USF 2000 debut. And what better place to debut than at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, right? I mean, it's a perfect story. We didn't plan it that way. It just kind of everything came together for us. Again, I would just say it's just kind of the Lord opening the right doors at the right time. And I'm so proud of him that this is where he's making his USF, his Road to Indy debut at the greatest racetrack in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a wonderful story, and I put no pressure on him at all in terms of what we're looking for. I know he's going to do his best, and that's all we're asking of him.
And already it's a big weekend with it being Labor Day weekend out there, and you have the big go across town in Clermont at almost at O'Reilly Raceway Park, but I know that's not it. Let's talk about that race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's a makeup race, obviously, and I believe it's a triple header, I believe, correct?
It is. It's,
okay.
It's USF, it's Pro 2000, and the MX-5, also a rally cross.
Oh, well, why don't we just get you an MX-5 Cup car, too, and just get, have well, you,
you know,
with her?
I might. You know, I was actually thinking about a Silver Crown car, but, you know.
We're talking with Will Mary. Talk with Bill Mariotti, Mariotti Motorsport and Legacy Autosport, bringing on Simon Sykes. And, yeah, speaking of Silver Crown, I actually was in the deep depths of the internet a while back, and I saw that they were trying to get that onto road course racing in the early 2000s, which I thought was pretty interesting.
I'd pay big money to see that. I love Silver Crown cars. We, when we were at Lucas, we stayed, and that was the feature of the night, was the Silver Crown race, and, Cody's brother actually won that race. But, I mean, those cars are beasts. I just love them. They're pure horsepower. I mean, if you can wheel one of those cars, I think you can do anything. And I'd love to take a lap around a road course in one of those cars.
The first race that I took my now wife to was the night before the 500, when it was then Pro Mazda, and USF 2000 ran there. I had some friends running that series, and we're walking back for the paddock, and we're walking along the fence line. And, you know, Silver Crown cars are on track, and... Yeah. She's walking towards the fence. I go, nope. She's walking towards the fence. Nope. I go, you'll see why when we get back to the room. We get back to the room, and I showed her videos of Silver. Actually, no, we sat to the stands, and a Silver Crown car lost its right rear wheel in turn one. Yeah. I look at her. I go, that is why we don't stand by the fence there, because, they're quick cars, but when it goes wrong, it goes wrong. All right, let's talk about the 2016 Indianapolis 500 with Oriel Servia. Obviously, it was the big one. What kind of experience was that like for you, being a first-time entrant in that race?
You know, it was really, to say surreal is too cliche. Everybody uses it, but I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it was, since I was a kid, I wanted to race there and win there. You know, I replayed the finish, you know, 1,000 times in my mind, taking the checkered flag. Knew I wasn't going to get to that point, but just being involved at that level, and Sam Schmidt was incredibly good to us, and put our name on the pit wall. He didn't have to do that. It wasn't in the contract. So we had Marotti written across the pit wall. And I mean, I think the first time I saw it, I didn't know he was going to do it. Somebody called my attention to it. I think I started crying, but it was so special because, you know, we were involved in every aspect of it. And, Oriel's such a good driver, and he was great to be with. He was just hearing the feedback with he and the engineers. And then the fact that I was able to bring my family out, a lot of my childhood friends came out. We had an entire entourage. So I got to enjoy it with a bunch of folks. But on the grid that morning, with, you know, the national anthem and back home again in Indiana, even now, probably one of the most emotional things I've experienced apart from the birth of my kids. It was just an amazing experience. And we were running fourth at lap 196. But we're in the same fuel situation that Alexander Rossi was in. And, you know, some said we should have rolled the dice and kept him out there. We ended up bringing him in. We had a little problem with the pit stop, and we ended up finishing 12th. But not bad for the first run. You know, it was a good thing. So we're hoping now to take Simon and develop him all the way through the ladder series. And I hope that we'll run together with Simon in the Indianapolis 500.
As I was about to ask you, have you guys talked about 2021 and a full USF 2000 or Indy Pro 2000 schedule yet?
Yeah, we actually have, and we're making plans. We want to try to. We're going to do Indy this weekend. Maybe do one or two more races this year with Simon, but really set our sights on a full program USF 2000 for next year, and then move up the ladder as quickly as we can and as efficiently as we can. You know, and a lot of that has to do with dollars, and we're trying a little different model in the ladder series. We're really trying to use an IndyCar model where we're bringing sponsors to the program and be less dependent upon driver dollars. Another thing I was told couldn't be done, but I think we can prove that wrong. So, you know, our goal would be great in, you know, next year, full USF 2000 season in 21 and 22, 23, 24, Indianapolis 500. So that's the goal.
And before I let you go, Will, I can't let this go because people are, you know, will want to know more. But you also do middays at WTIC News Talk 1080. So I guess that people would ask, why would a radio guy, and I get that question too here in Chicago, why would a radio guy gravitate towards racing?
Well, there's more to the story. And the other part of the story is that for the last 25 years, I've been a pastor. And I pastor a pretty significant church in Connecticut that my wife and I started 21 years ago. The radio came as an afterthought. 10 years ago in September, the former governor of Connecticut called me one day and said, "Hey, TIC's offered me a radio show, but I don't want to do it without you. Will you come in?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I haven't done radio. I don't know. I don't know what to do. And they kind of looked at me like I was his little brother. But here it is 10 years later, got my own show, and it's going really well. And I'm again, just feel very blessed. And I just like a lot of stuff, Jeremy. You know,
yeah.
I love pastoring. I love racing. I love radio. So I'm trying to fit as much as I can in a limited time space.
Well, we can hear Will 9 to noon Eastern on WTIC. Where else can people find out more about you and kind of keep up?
Radio.com is the Edgecom app. If you want to get radio.com, just download that, and then you can listen literally anywhere in the world that has internet. WTIC News Talk 1080.
And where can people follow you on social media to get more about, you know, you, follow your the race exploits of the team, et cetera, et cetera?
We're on all the social media channels at Marotti Autosport, Marotti, Marotti Autosport, and then I also have personal pages, Will Marotti as well. So we're out there. We're easily found.
Fantastic. Will Marotti, Marotti Autosport, Legacy Autosport, thanks for joining us. And once we get Simon signed up or somebody signed up to a full-time deal, let's come back and get that driver on. We'll do some more cool stuff.
Sure enough. Jeremy, thank you so much. Really love being with you today.
Well, great talk with you as well. Coming up next, Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider, joins us on Inside Open. We'll talk about the IMS race, you know, the Indy 500, and Gateway.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Three races in 2 weekends, still not the most that IndyCar's done so far this season, but nonetheless, one of them was the greatest spectacle in racing. Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider from the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, joins us, and I've got to say, the 500, okay, you know, not bad. Race one of Gateway, that wasn't too awful, but race two, I think since we didn't have the schmozzle in the start, it actually was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting. I would have liked to have seen a little more passing. You know, the aero challenges on the short ovals is still pretty evident, in my opinion. I got to find a way to get these cars side by side, but certainly a deserving win for Joseph Newgarden there in race number two.
Oh, definitely. And Takuma Sato, I will say this. I don't know what he's been on the second half of the season, but he's been doing good. We saw him win the 500. We saw him almost challenge Scott Dixon there for the win. Had he not whitewalled it, I think he would have had three top tens in three races.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And he's doing it all at 43 years of age. I mean, this idea that, you know, race car drivers, once they get north of 40, I don't know, you know, I don't know where it comes from. It's kind of, I think people just assume that it's like a lot of other professional sports, that after you get north of 40, that all of a sudden you need to retire and hang it up. But I don't think in racing that's necessarily the case. It's been pretty impressive. And you think back to last year and how good of a season he had last year, winning at Barber and then scoring the win in St. Louis. So it's pretty impressive, honestly, the way Takuma Sato has kind of gotten better with age. And you're right, he's on a nice little stretch here, obviously, with the big win at the Indianapolis 500, and then was really strong at Gateway as well. So, yeah, Takuma Sato is on quite a hot streak right now.
Well, I got to admit, when he made that pass there with about, what was it, 25 to go around Scott Dixon, it's like that pass alone, that one seemed like it wasn't more of a, you know, Mike Hall telling Scott Dixon, you know, back off, let's save some fuel. That was more of a, I'm coming, here I am, good luck getting around me sort of pass.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. I mean, at the end of the 500, he was just as strong, if not stronger, than Scott Dixon. And you know, people will talk about the finish and whether if Scott would have gotten a chance in the last four laps if he could get back around Takuma Sato. But there was no doubt. I mean, I think a lot of people slept on Sato all 2 weeks in the month of August. You know, Scott Dixon might have gotten all the attention. Marco Andretti was up there as well. The Andretti Autosport stable was really strong, and then certainly attention's always paid, you know, to the guys that struggle, and the biggest storyline was Team Penske struggling. But I don't think a lot of people talked about just how good Takuma Sato was all throughout practice and qualifying. And not only that, but his track record in Indianapolis. I mean, being a race winner there already and having a couple other opportunities where he might have should have won. You know, the year before he finished third, everyone talks about Rossi and Pagano, but Sato's got that place figured out at Indianapolis. So it was a very deserving win. You're right, that pass around was a power move, sent a message for sure. And ultimately, it was good enough for him to win.
And I do want to talk about the struggles, not only within Penske, but it seems like the Chevrolet struggles this year, because they seem to be amplified a little bit more because of the dominance throughout the month of August with Andretti Autosport and Ganassi Racing really doing quite well in practice. But I want to talk about those two crashes that we had off of Turn 4, Chris Denari. Your colleague had to call both of those. That first one with Connor Daly, that was just a weird hits that concrete patch, spins, wax into the wall, and you know Oliver Askew overcorrects and hits the wall himself. I mean that, and I saw a lot of it on Twitter. People saying that was almost reminiscent of Ari's IROC crash back in '97. I want to say.
Yeah, no, it was a colossal hit. I mean, it's just that front stretch. There's just such a funneling effect, and it doesn't matter what's racing there, whether it's over wheel cars or stock cars. When you have problems out of four, there's just a lot of places you can hit in a very short amount of time. So it certainly looked like Connor was just trying to get a little too much on that restart. The restarts were key because it was so hot, and because in the last couple of years it has been a little bit difficult to pass at Indy, at least compared to maybe those early DW12 days. So Connor makes a mistake, and then poor Oliver Askew through the smoke. Just tries to get out of the way and avoid the accident. And, man, that thing looked an abrupt left. It was a colossal hit. I don't know if he was diagnosed with a concussion or not. But, boy, Jeremy, when he got out of that race car, I'm not sure he knew what county he was in, maybe not even what state either. It was a big hit for Oliver Askew. But, thankfully, he was okay and ultimately just had some bruised legs from his knees knocking together, because it was a big, big hit there against that wall.
And I think the biggest crash I've seen there in a very, very long time was that one that came with four to go, because, yeah, Sato just passed that, where Spencer Pigot, who – kid's good. Let's just say that. I think that when we get him in a full-time ride, he's going to really prove some people wrong. But, man, that hit against the attenuator, we were talking about that on WIBC the day after.
Yeah, and I was just really glad, ultimately, that when Spencer hit, that he was by himself enough on the racetrack with the way that he shot back across the track after hitting that attenuator. That could have been catastrophic and really, really dangerous. I mean, it was a big hit as it was, and Spencer obviously took a precautionary trip to the hospital to get checked out and was cleared pretty quickly. But that's what I was worried about. Thankfully, you know, the four or five cars that were coming out of turn four when he hit were able to woe it down and maneuver through that accident. But it was huge. And you know, I know it's cliche, the old, like, well, it's a testament to how safe these race cars are, but man, it's the truth. Like, some of those accidents that we had, I'm sorry, guys are taking trips to the hospital and could have been seriously injured in an accident like that 20, 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Same when Oliver Askew's hit. The accident I called in turn one with Alex Palou, I know television didn't really give a great replay of that, but I'm telling you, that was a colossal hit when that car wiggled. It honestly reminded me a lot of Sebastian Bourdais' qualifying accident from a couple years ago, where when it wiggled, it hooked, and it was a big hit. But ultimately, everybody walked away and everyone will race again. And that says a lot about these cars. It says a lot about the safer barrier and the technology that has come a long, long way in IndyCar.
Yeah, and I have to say this. I did see that on TV. We have the TV on, because with Antenna TV, it's kind of hard to sync IndyCar radio. I need to invent something to where I can sync all that together. But nonetheless, yeah, saw that one at the back end of them coming around turn two. Another interesting one was the Alexander Rossi crash in turn two, where he was trying to come through the back, which, by the way, I have to give a hand to Kyle Novak. That was the right call to make on Alexander Rossi there in pit road. He shouldn't come out that far.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I would agree. I would totally agree. I mean, listen, the Indianapolis pit row is super tight. It's super narrow. It has been for years. Everybody knows it. And every year, someone's going to have their race affected by a penalty like that, or by contact that just, you know, ruins the race. I was honestly surprised that neither Rossi or Sato had enough damage to the race cars from that hit that that took either one of them out of contention. Obviously, Rossi then drove probably a little too angry and simply made a mistake and spun in two. But I'm with you. I think it was the right hit or the right penalty that he should have deserved. He just can't blend all the way over to that third line against the pit wall when you've got a car already out there. There's a second lane, a middle lane for a reason. And if that far right lane is taken up, you kind of, I think it's just kind of understood that you've got a heat. So he was trying to get what he could get, and he kind of paid for it. And ultimately, it was a surprising, disappointing run for Alexander Rossi, who's four previous attempts at Indianapolis, Jeremy, have just been sensational. So yeah. Rossi, it's just one thing after another for that poor guy in 2020.
And another driver who seems to have rotten luck at IMS Granite, he also has a win, is Scott Dixon. Led over half the race, couldn't close the deal, at, you know, because obviously Sato was just too fast, too strong. And I think that's where I'm not going to sit there with Mike Hall and, you know, Michael Cannon and say, well, this is what you need to do, because they obviously are, they've got more brains than I do. I'll admit that. But maybe instead of just dominating like he has the past several times, he's coming second, third, or fourth, maybe let the car come to him.
Yeah, no, I think there's a case to be made there. And ultimately, I just wonder if guys will reevaluate where you want to be heading into the final 10 laps. I just think it's too important that you need to be leading, not necessarily setting up that final pass, because you don't know if you're going to get that opportunity or not. But, yeah, I mean, you could tell. I mean, Scott, I think he understands. He's been around this sport for a long time. He knows that ultimately was one that got away, and when it's all said and done and he puts a bow on his career, if he only ends up with one Indianapolis 500 win, I think 2020 might be the biggest one that he'll feel like, slipped between the fingers, because he had the dominant car. He was strong all day long. And again, you tip your cap to what Takuma Sato and Ray Hall Litterman Lanigan did. I mean, they were strong towards the end of the race. But, yeah, I'm with you. I don't know if you pick through the strategy, if there's anything Scott Dixon could have done differently in that race. It was just a misfortunate set of circumstances. And man, it's just a proven case that sometimes the fastest car doesn't always win. And we've seen throughout the history of motorsports, sometimes that's the case.
A couple other points on the 500 before we go over to Worldwide Technology Raceway. We talked about Penske briefly, how he's been having struggles. That team had their struggles at their own track, but I think it was more the Chevrolets that were having the issues this year, except with the exception of Aero Schmidt Peterson, you know, with Pato O'Ward, which, I'm sorry, O'Ward has got to be one of the shining lights out of that team, not discounting Oliver Askew, but this year was just Honda got the notes right.
Yeah, and sometimes that happens, right? I mean, it's secular. I mean, you're going to have your ups and downs, and one engine provider is probably always going to hit it a little bit better than the other one. And you just hope you can kind of counter that sometimes with fuel mileage, sometimes with cars being better in race space. And ultimately, it just seemed like this was Honda's year. But you're right. I mean, you know, I think people were worried about Team Penske, but when qualifying weekend rolled around and Ed Carpenter and Connor Daly both struggled in qualifying. I mean, I tip the cap to Rinus VK. That was a great qualifying run for him. But when Ed Carpenter Racing as a whole wasn't as impressive as what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, that's when I knew, okay, this is definitely a Chevrolet issue. Tony Kanaan was very quiet as well, driving for AJ Foyt Racing in a Chevrolet. And TK is always a guy who finds a way to charge to the front. Fernando Alonso was just a complete non-factor. And we know how good Fernando can be at Indianapolis. A very short sample size, but when you give him a good car, we know how strong he can be. So, yeah, the top to bottom, it just seemed like Chevrolet was missing a little bit. And you're right. It's really a testament to how good Joseph Newgarden and Pato O'Ward are racing right now. The fact that those two were kind of in the hunt, at least, towards the end of that race, with Chevrolet clearly being a little bit down on power and setup.
And I've got to ask also, because we saw how strong Andretti Autosport was throughout the month for practice and qualifying, what did they miss on there to just completely have their best driver be their part-time driver in seventh place?
I don't know, man. It's a fantastic question. I mean, as strong as they were at practice to only come away with the pole position. And don't get me wrong, that matters a great deal. But we were thinking heading into qualifying weekend, like, okay, Andretti Autosport might sweep the front row, and they may have the top two or three favorites to win the race, and Marco, Ryan Hunter Ray, and obviously Alexander Rossi. So, you know, when you do the postmortem on Andretti Autosport, the fact that none of those guys were really in contention, I don't know how you can't look at it and say, boy, this was a bit of a failure on race day. So, I don't know exactly what it was, but for whatever reason, when we dropped the green flag, I mean, Ryan Hunter Ray charged a second in that first stint and then had a bad pit stop. It was just never really a factor in that entire organization. It just went a lot of guys up there competing for Michael Andretti.
All right, so let's talk about Worldwide Technology Raceway. And tip of the cap to Mike Kitchell. I've known Mike a while since I started. You've probably known him as long as I have with IndyCar. Goes over, does his own thing. And I tell you what, that video he produced for Andretti Autosport for race one, fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's great. Mike's he's done a great job with that kind of stuff for years. So, I think everyone got a really, really big kick out of that. Transitioning from Indy then down to St. Louis. So Mike does a first-class job with everything.
Yeah, let's also talk about that incident. And that, in my opinion, is the story of the weekend, because, once again, people are going to sit there and say, well, willpower held up. No, you had Alex Palou pop out, and I think that's what started the domino effect of everybody just hitting each other in the back.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was the rookie driver who, you know, just – doesn't have a lot of, you know, rolling starts like that on a short oval, trying to get everything he can. And then, obviously, you know, you're sitting so low in an Indy car that when a car in front of you goes, it's just such a natural reaction for Simon Pagenaud to think, okay, we're racing for Oliver Askew. And then certainly the guys in the back like Zach Meech as well to think, okay, it's go time. So that's just a classic example of one guy makes a mistake and five, six guys pay for it. So, it's fortunate, especially with some of the guys that got caught up in it that have had tough years anyways, like Rossi, like Beach, like Ed Carpenter and Marco Andretti, that needed good runs. Obviously, things didn't go well for them to qualify as far back as they did. So, a bit of a disappointment to see, you know, before the green flag, stacking up six of them like that. But, hey, that's how it goes sometimes.
Race one, Scott Dixon, your winner. Race two, Joseph Newgarden. Do we head to Mid-Ohio in a couple weeks? And that's one of the things we were waiting on to release this podcast. Word from IndyCar that the 12th and the 13th will be, the 11th and the 12th will be IndyCar weekend at Mid-Ohio, but we still haven't heard official word yet.
Yeah, my understanding is that everyone's good to go. They're just kind of waiting on the state to give approval for the event. So, I think Mid-Ohio wants to do it. IndyCar wants to do it. The drivers and teams want to do it. Certainly if there's any hope of drawing a crowd and selling tickets, you need it to be announced and confirmed soon. But, we're kind of in a holding pattern and waiting to see on ultimately what's going to happen.
Nick Yeoman, IndyCar Radio, our IndyCar analyst. Thanks for joining us. We'll chat with you in a couple weeks.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.
Charlie Ante joins us next on Inside Open Wheel. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, this comes to the point in the show where I must offer a little bit of an apology. Last week, I know we were going to do the huge Indy 500 wrap-up show, but I got wrapped up in a project of my own. Still working on it. Almost done, though. Charlie Ante joins me. And Charlie, I have to say, if you ever get a house, I know it's probably not in the cards anytime soon, but do yourself a favor and have somebody else do the work for you. Trust me on this one.
Actually, prices in Manhattan are planning. It's probably going to go down pretty soon, so who knows?
Yeah, well, we'll see. And prices are going down everywhere. That's the good news. But nonetheless, we're almost done putting in the floor, so that's a good thing. All right. So these past couple weeks, we've had a lot of racing action, especially on the IndyCar side. I've got to say this. I'm not the type to, oh, we'll talk about other things. Oh, I want to talk about this big thing to keep you listening around. I want to get in this debate early on. there were two instances over the past three races where people were yelling, why didn't race control throw a red flag? Ladies and gentlemen, this isn't stock car racing. You can't get these tires warmed up, especially old tires, and expect everybody to go sailing in the turn one and easily make it out. There would have been another yellow because somebody would have, you know, tried a bonsai move on the inside or, you know, just lost their tires. And then, oh, there's a crash in turn one or turn two somewhere, you know, whether it's at Indy or WWT Raceway. And besides, with the red flag situation that didn't happen at Indy, it's a good thing because it would have taken at least an hour to get that attenuator fixed. I know I saw pictures Monday morning after the 500 of them fixing the attenuator. So I've got to say this, Roger Penske's probably thinking, what else can I put there at the end of pit road, or do I have to extend it on an oval race? Because holy crap, is that too dangerous?
I'll admit to being one of those people that when I saw it, I was like, oh, they're probably going to red flag it. That you know, what you're saying kind of makes sense.
You know, because I'll admit, I sat and watched the race with my wife, and I saw, you know, I told her beforehand, I go, well, we still got to get this stupid crash yellow out of the way. Sure enough, we did. Unfortunately, it came at the hands of Spencer Pigot because, you know, I'll admit, I like Spencer. You know, I've watched Spencer come up through the ranks throughout the years, and he's got a good head on the shoulders. I feel really bad the way the crash happened to him, but unfortunately, it was that stupid crash.
Do you remember what position he was in when he crashed?
That I actually do not. I would have to go back and look at the running order for that. Let me see here. See if there's a lap chart. I think there might be. Some of them might have it. But he was running by himself, so that kind of, you know, helped him. Mm-hmm. That was an awful, awful crash. Period.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the nightmares at Indy is hitting that attenuator, isn't it? I mean, fortunately, yeah. he lost it coming out of four, right? So yeah. He was sideways basically from the exit of four all the way down the front straightaway. So you scrub off a lot of speed doing that. But even still, you know, hitting that thing is not what you want.
No, and I'm not finding a lap chart anywhere, but regardless, this has been, it was, to say it was one of the strangest Indianapolis 500s on record, and that's something I wanted to talk to Nick Young about earlier, is a complete understatement, because it was just weird. I mean, first of all, you had Scott Dixon leading over 100 laps, you know, over half the race, flat out dominating the race, and then, you know, that last stint, here comes Sato once again. And it's like I told Nick, and I'm going to pose the same question to you. Can Scott Dixon win another 500? Because it seems like every time that he gets out front in the 500, he dominates, but he can't close the deal.
I would never discount Scott Dixon to win anything ever. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. He can win any race he enters. He can definitely win another 500.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens. And, you know, the second question poses is, when will Joseph Newgarden win his 500? And someone brought up the point online. Remember, it took Al Unser Jr. 10 years to win his first 500.
Yeah, how long has Newgarden been in IndyCar? It's been a while, hasn't it?
Oh, boy. Give me a second. I would have to look that one. Actually, I can look that up straight from that.
I remember seeing him at Baltimore with, like, Dragon Speed back in, like, 2011, maybe?
2012 was his first race because he won the 2011 Indy Lights Championship. And then, remember that announcement, it was a rarity because he saw a lot of drivers that would come in from Indy Lights. They would have to pay their own way. That was, he's offered a multi-year contract with Fisher-Hartman Racing. But mm-hmm. He didn't have to bring all the money like normal rookies would have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that was rare in and of itself. So it's he's been in the series. This is going to be his 10th season. He's already won two championships.
Well, yeah, I mean he's one of the top drivers for sure.
Oh well, you knew the second that he got in that Penske ride that he would be a threat to win title after title. I wouldn't be surprised if he. If he tries to give Scott Dixon hell the next couple of races, but that would also depend on if the series goes to Mid-Ohio, which we are still waiting confirmation, as you heard earlier from Nick Yeoman. Everything's in place for both the series and the track. They just need to get confirmation from the state of Ohio and Governor Mike DeWine. Be interesting to see if that happens. If they're smart, they just run it without fans.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be kind of the perfect happy medium. But also, it really does, like, you have to kind of, you have to keep the
calculated risk?
The healthcare leaders.
Epidemiologists.
Epidemiologists, yeah. The state epidemiologists, I think, are really the ones you have to listen to for these things. But it seems like what sports in general are doing is the bubble concept, right? Like, in, I know in Formula One, like, they keep the drivers in a bubble, they keep the mechanics in a bubble, and they keep, like, the whole circus sort of in a bigger bubble. So as long as IndyCar is doing that, which, you know, I don't know if they are or not, but if any sport's not doing it, it would probably be them or NASCAR. You know, as long as they're smart about it, and they listen to the epidemiologists.
Yeah, I know before the Indy 500, Jay Fry came out and said, you know, we've done X amount of tests. None of them came back positive, which is good. I almost said negative. That would be a bad thing if they all came back positive. But it's interesting to see what happens in the next couple of weeks, especially because what they're saying, you know, what the national epidemiologists are saying, it could get worse into the fall. We still have to be at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and we've got the season finale at St. Petersburg tentatively scheduled. Now, that one's a tougher one because you still got to shut down the streets and set up the track.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing with having a race in Indy is that most of the teams are around there anyways.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but most of them. So you're drastically cutting down on the travel.
Yeah, I mean, at worst, you have, you know, Mike Shank in Ohio, Dale Coyne here in Plainfield, and half of A.J. Foyt down in Texas.
As Penske's in North Carolina, right?
Yes, they're also in North Carolina. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a little bit of travel, but it's not as much. So, yeah, that's my thought on that, I guess.
Other series taking long hiatuses. I'm considering IndyCar's a long hiatus until we get official word from Mid-Ohio. But again, it sounds likely that they will be running Mid-Ohio the 11th and the 12th. Your series, the F1600s, they're not racing until October 16th through the 18th. This long layoff, it's great for everybody because it gives everybody a chance to sit back, relax. Let's talk about pit race, which you are very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
do you want my thoughts on it, or was that?
Go ahead with your thoughts on it, because I do want. There's something else I want to talk about.
Well, I know what I'm biased because it was my home track growing up. I sort of still consider it my home track, even though I don't live in Pittsburgh. But it's grown into like a really, really good racetrack. They extended it, I think, in 2015. And that kind of doubled the length of the track, and it turned it into, from sort of a simple club track, into something that, if they increase sort of the infrastructure, and then it could be something that pro series go to. And I think we mentioned before, Moto America has been going there for a couple of years now. So it's a great track to drive on. It's a really beautiful area. You're sort of at the top of a hill, and you can see some of the rolling western Pennsylvania hills. There's always a lot of wind up there, and it's a really good track.
I was going to say, because I remember it was just that short 2-mile course. They extended it. They also did a little bit of that final right-hander, or the second to last right-hander. They had a little chicane there for Moto America. Mm-hmm. Are they trying to get more pro series to the Keystone State with that extension?
I'm not sure if they're quite there yet, because there's no grandstands. There's right. One sort of hill to driver's left of turn one, and you can see like 80% of the track from there. But there's no, you know, the spectator facilities are kind of sparse. There's no runoff, all the runoff is grass. There's no gravel traps. There's no paved runoff. There's no fencing. They just have the sort of the metal, what are they, not jersey barriers, but the Armco.
Yep.
So maybe they are. I mean, I know that the people that bought it a couple years ago have put a lot of money into it. They put up a new race control building. I think last year was the first year for it. So who knows? I don't really know exactly what's in their future, what their plans are. I don't think that they're quite there yet to get like an IMSA or IndyCar, but you know, if they put a little bit more money in there, then they can get there for sure.
Well, let's see what happens with IMSA in the next couple of years. I know that they came out and said that because of dwindling GTLM class numbers that they're going to allow the LMP3s into the series. I think we talked about that in the previous iteration. They should have let LMP3s when Prototype Challenge came across. So we're about, what, a decade ahead of our time?
Yeah, I guess the question is their pace, like the pace difference between them and the other categories? And just is it you know, is it safe? And it may be. I'm not asking that in the sense that, like, you know, is it safe? Blah, blah, blah. But just like, you know, as probably the primary thing to think about.
No, you're not wrong there. All right, so let's talk about some results real quick from S1600 F2000. Also pulling up Formula Atlantic, as last weekend they were at Summit Point. S1600, it looks like Jackson Lee took the win in race one, races two and three. Dylan Christie took those wins. Still have Simon Sykes leading that championship after drops, 421 to Jackson Lee's 369. Brandon Dixon leading the points right now in F2000. Bob Wright taking the win in race one. Race two goes to Brandon Dixon. And in the Atlantics, as I pull that up, they haven't run since Pittsburgh. So their next race will be Pittsburgh, Virginia. Looks like they still need to update their points, so we'll worry about that a little bit down the road. So big gap for them, big gap for F4, FR Americas also coming up. They finalized that they're actually going to run the USGP weekend. We've talked about that over and over again, and from what I'm hearing, the FR Americas drivers will be in the garages, which is huge for them because, you know, there's not going to be many fans in the stands regardless, but still, that's just great for these kids who want to move up to Formula One someday to kind of realize this is where I need to be.
So they're going to be stationed in the F1 garages?
Yeah, FR Americas is going to be stationed in the F1 garages.
Yeah, I don't really know if that does anything for their career, but it's kind of cool to just sort of drive out, you know, F1 style straight out from the garage.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything for their careers, but it, you know, it gives them something to work for, at least.
I guess so. I mean, if I were in their position, I'd say, oh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not really. I wouldn't really think much more of it than that.
Yeah, that's true. Then again, I've been spending the past 9 days on my knees bending over, pounding in wood. It's not been fun. All right, so this weekend, the Road to Indy has a triple header at the road course at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Same weekend as the big go over at Lucas Oil Raceway. Going to be a busy weekend for sports, motorsports, I should say, in the Indianapolis area. We'll cover that next week. Also, we'll have plenty of interviews. I will say this. In November, we are going to talk to the man who sings Back Home Again in Indiana. He also sings the national anthem here for the Blackhawks in Chicago. His name is Jim Cornelison, so we'll talk to him about, you know, how he got involved in racing and what he does, and also his charity that he really tries to push. It's very interesting to hear about that. We'll talk to him in a couple of weeks, but I've got to say this. Before we go, they need to do something about these oval packages on the IndyCar with the windscreen. Yeah.
In relation to
racing, because seemed like it was one of, it almost seemed like it was a Hanford device race for those cars, especially Gateway. Yeah. Where you could you could catch up to somebody, but you couldn't really pass them.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I thought I didn't see the second race at Gateway, but I saw the first one. I thought it was fairly exciting.
I heard both of them because there's no way I was going to stop and watch them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that first start was a cluster anyway.
Yeah. What was the? So they sort of, was it the accordion effect? Like somebody started accelerating and then realized that they weren't going yet, and
that's what I think it might have been. But what it looks like Palou was the one who jumped out, and that's what kind of started the whole thing.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because I saw. I mean, my first thought was, oh yeah, he jumped out, but he said that he jumped out because the car in front of him was checking up, and rather than run, it was like, you know, he had the choice of either running into the back of him or pulling off to the left.
But remember, it's Will Power's fault. It's Will Power's fault. He brought the drivers down too slow.
Maybe. And it was a late flag too. So, who knows? It didn't look good. That's for sure.
I don't ask these questions. As you and I both remarked, that was a pretty, amateur start.
Yeah, it did not look good.
All right, so next week we'll have updates from the road course at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. As always, I'm Jeremy Scott. Thanks for listening to us on Inside Open Wheel. We'll catch you next week. And I promise, because I'm not going to be laying down floor. Take care, everybody.